Welcome back to the Stronger by Science podcast. My name is Eric Trexler. I am your one and only full-time permanent host. But for today's episode, I am going to be joined by a special temporary guest co-host. His name is Greg Knuckles. Greg, thanks for joining me.
It is an honor and a privilege, and I thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. So I mentioned in last week's episode, we are changing up the format a little bit. We're doing episodes every single week, so they're going to be twice as frequent, but about half as long. And last week, we ran out of time to do some of our Q&As, so we decided that for the first time in a while, we're going to do a total Q&A episode today. So it's all going to be question and answer. So we will dive right into that. But before we do that, a couple things. If you enjoy the show and you want to support it, there are several ways that you can do that. You can like, rate, and subscribe the show and share it with others. You could use our discount code at bulksupplements.com. The code is SBSPOD. That gets you a 5% discount at bulksupplements.com. You could also subscribe to the Mass Research Review that Greg and I are both co-authors of. And finally, if you want to check out our diet app called Macro Factor, we do have a free trial, so you can take it for a spin, see if you like it, and that would be a great way to support the show, and we would certainly appreciate that. So now we're going to get into some questions and answers. I am going to start, and we're going to go back and forth here, but first, I got a question from Dylan, and Dylan asked, I've got a question about protein metabolism, was looking at a paper. Protein overfeeding resulted in no gains in body fat, even though the average caloric increase was around 800 calories. So Dylan was wondering if there's even a possible mechanism that our body can use to convert amino acids into free fatty acids and then store them ultimately as fat tissue. So basically the question was, you know, the root of it, there are a couple papers looking at very high protein overfeeding. And in those papers, there's a curious lack of fat storage. So basically they said, hey, you know, have these really high protein intakes. We're talking upwards of 3 or 4 grams per kilogram per day. So, you know, the RDA for protein in America, the guideline says to shoot for like 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body mass per day. We're talking about in these overfeeding studies, 3.5, sometimes even close to 4.5 grams per kilogram, which is a ton of protein. But in the course of these studies, these individuals who were free living individuals were instructed, hey, eat these really high protein intakes, but keep doing your thing, lift some weights, we'll see what happens. And so over the course of 8 weeks, you know, in one of these studies, there was really a series of three of these overfeeding studies by Antonio and colleagues. In one of them, for example, like the poster mentioned here, theoretically, the high protein group was eating like 800 extra calories compared to the control group. And over an 8 week span of time, they did not seem to accumulate any additional fat mass compared to the other group eating 800 fewer calories. And that is a really astronomical calorie gap between groups. So before I get into some of the applied research on the topic, the first part of the question was, is it even possible for us to really do anything with these extra calories that are coming from protein overfeeding? Can we use them for energy? Can we store them for fat? And the very simple answer is yes. So our body is pretty good at stuff, which is one of the reasons that there's so much argument in the nutrition world, is because like, you can go on a really wide range of diets and feel pretty okay. And if you're really excited about your diet, you might even feel great about it. You know, so that's why you see so many people saying, I went virtually no carb, or I went really low fat, or all animal product, or all plant product. And everybody's stoked about it, and everybody feels good.
Yeah, there are about a half dozen different redundant pathways to accomplish virtually anything that you'd want to do. With very few exceptions, like, you know, essential amino acids. There are a handful that your body can't manufacture itself. Most other things you'd want to do related to energy metabolism, there are a lot of roads that lead to Rome.
Exactly. So when our body's breaking down carbs, a lot of times what we're trying to basically get to, the kind of end destination, is let's turn this into some pyruvate or some acetyl-CoA, and let's plug those into the pathways of energy metabolism. We can throw those, you know, we can do glycolysis with carbs, obviously. We can also, you know, throw that acetyl-CoA into the Krebs cycle, use some of the products from there, throw them into the electron transport chain. We're using these kind of basic foundational building blocks that contain energy, throwing them through these pathways and getting ATP as a result. And whatever's left over, we can find a way to kind of make sure that we're storing fat when we have excess energy. And, you know, we can do so much inner conversion because when we're breaking down carbs, when we're breaking down fats, when we're breaking down protein after we kind of strip the amino group off of extra protein in the diet, you know, we take that amino group off and then we're left with what's left, and we can still turn that into pyruvate, turn that into acetyl-CoA, or it'll turn into an intermediate that can go right into the Krebs cycle or the TCA cycle. So when we're talking about metabolism of carbs and fats and protein, it's kind of like dealing with currency. Like, we can exchange it when we need to exchange it. You're not going to end up with, you know, a huge amount of currency and say, ah, it's the wrong currency. There's just nothing I can do here. There are exchanges that are possible, and we're ultimately breaking it down into the same energy containing building blocks that we're throwing into pathways, whether those pathways are going toward creating ATP or we're just funneling that towards storage for later use. So macronutrient metabolism is extremely flexible. If we have a bunch of extra calories coming in from fat, we can deal with that energy. And the way we deal with it is we either oxidize it for ATP in the short term, or we convert it to something that we can store for later. And in some cases, that will be fat. Now, a lot of times people will look at these types of questions and they will kind of skip a step and go straight to PubMed. Like, I think there's a lot of value. We've talked about this before. If you want to get a good handle on general metabolism, you want to start at the textbook rather than going straight to the individual experimental evidence, right? So sometimes I'll see people who are like looking for experimental evidence of protein getting directly converted to fat for storage. You want to take several steps back, get the lay of the land for metabolism, and then start looking for what actually happens in experimental conditions. So a great example that's analogous is a lot of times people will wonder if we can store extra carbs as fat, you know, if you have a really high carb diet and you're overfeeding. And it's the same kind of question. Do we have pathways where we can convert carbohydrate into fat and then store that? Sure, we do. But the body would much rather just burn off the extra carbs to the extent that it can and just store the dietary fat that's already fat. So a lot of times we'll see these really high carb overfeeding studies, and experimentally it looks like there's not a lot of conversion to fat, you know, just straight conversion carb to fat. It doesn't mean it's not possible. It doesn't mean we don't have the pathways. It's just the body is crunching the numbers and saying, I'd much rather just oxidize the carbs and store the fat. And if I really must, then sure, I'll do some conversion of carbs to fat. So it's a kind of a similar deal with protein. Protein, if we want to store it as fat, if we have to, we can ultimately convert it all the way down to like acetyl-CoA and then do lipogenesis with that acetyl-CoA, and we can store it away. So that's the short answer is, yeah, if you're overfeeding, whether you're overfeeding carb, fat, protein, whatever, there are going to be differences in the pathways getting utilized in terms of, you know, what our body prefers to do in certain situations. The efficiency of fat storage will be different. So if you overfeed with 800 calories worth of carbs versus fat versus protein, you're probably going to have, you know, just due to the thermic effect of feeding, the fat is going to get stored very, very easily. The thermic effect of carbohydrate is a little bit higher. We might not store it with the exact same efficiency. And then protein has the highest thermic effect. So if you were going to say, I'm going to overfeed no matter what with 1,000 extra calories on top of what I'm already eating, what can I overfeed and have the smallest relative amount of fat gain? It probably would go in that order, right? So you'd have an easier time storing the most fat tissue coming from fat as in an overfeeding scenario, slightly less with carbs, but it's kind of negligible, and then slightly less again with protein due to the thermic effect. Now, one thing that I think is important to recognize when it comes to the specific studies being mentioned here by Antonio and colleagues, this is no fault of the participants or the researchers. I want to say that on the front end here. But I am very skeptical about the idea that there's these 800 extra calories and we simply don't know where they're going. I'm also skeptical that it's just 800 calories of like straight thermogenesis. Like that doesn't line up well with our understanding of metabolism and energetics. I think what you have to keep in mind with the studies by Antonio is these are free living participants and self-reported dietary data. So I think a really informative paper is one by Hahn and colleagues. Cody Hahn is actually one of our coaches at Stronger by Science. But they did a study where they had three different overfeeding conditions. And in one of them, it was they were trying to get people to just ramp up their whey protein week over week over week. So they said, like, week one, here, take some protein. But week two and week three and week four, all the way to week six, they were supposed to increase their protein intake by 25 grams every single week. And what happened in that study over 6 weeks, and they did very, very thorough nutrition reporting, it just didn't happen. Like the people started on high protein diets. And if you've ever tried to go from like a very high protein diet to a very, very high protein diet, it's not fun.
No.
And like you would only do it if you literally had to.
Yeah.
So like, I mean, they basically started around like 175 grams a day of protein and they were supposed to increase 25 grams every week for 6 weeks. They ended up getting to like 195 or 200 and being like, whatever, dude, I'm done. And actually their total calorie intake was lower than the other two groups because, you know, trying to force feed yourself whey protein, it sucks, and it's also very satiating. So what you'll find is if you're trying to give yourself 300 grams of whey or of protein a day, mostly coming from whey, you're probably going to find that you're not eating much else because you're very, very full. And unless someone's making you do it, you're probably going to do that for like 3 days and be like, this sucks. I'm not going to do this anymore.
So I've got a story related to that. I don't know if I've talked about this on the podcast before. I feel like I have, but I'm not positive. But back in the day, when I was like maybe 19 or 20 or so, I learned about DC like style bodybuilding, like dog crap training. And, you know, so I got into all of that, and there's nutrition recommendations that go along with it. And I don't remember all of them, but one of the kind of bedrocks, like one of the cornerstones of nutrition advice in that community is just like, you know, regardless of the details, just eat like 400 or 500 grams of protein per day and everything else will more or less sort itself out. So I was like, okay, cool. Like I'll give that a shot. So I tried, like I was tracking everything and I was averaging something north of 400 grams of protein for like 2 weeks. And I just said, fuck that. Like I can't do this. I can maybe shoot for 300 grams per day. And like I was in college as well. Like I had a meal plan. But like the cafeteria didn't have many like good, relatively low calorie, high protein options. So what my diet looked like at the time is they had this little salad bar where you could put like little cubes of ham on top of your salad. And like deli ham is pretty lean. So I would just like go and get a plate and just load it up with like little like tiny cubed ham slices and just eat that with a little like ham cubes and just eat that with a spoon. Which I imagine is probably more satiating than whey protein. And also ham is very salty. So I think
I was going to say, I hope that your blood pressure isn't too responsive to dietary sodium.
No, I don't think it is. I don't think I'm like a sodium blood pressure responder. But over just like the first week of doing that, I put on like 8 pounds, which I think was 100% water retention from how much deli ham I was eating. But yeah, that shit was fucking miserable, dude.
Yeah.
So anyone who is actually following that dietary advice, I don't think you benefit from eating that much protein, but if you are doing that and doing it consistently, you have a lot more willpower to eat protein than I do.
Yeah. So like I said, there's a study by Hahn and colleagues, which gives a window into like, what is the likelihood that a lot of people really are just going like 4.5 grams per kilogram per day and not having a huge, like, kind of like non-volitional reduction in calorie intake, or at least just a total replacement of their calories that they were, that would have been carbs and fat, just replacing that with protein. I mean, when you look at really meticulously reported studies like the one by Han and colleagues, you'll see it's not very typical for people to be able to say, oh yeah, I'll just like triple my protein intake or double it and I'll just leave everything else the same. Like, it's not easy to do.
Yeah.
And there's also a study by Bray and colleagues in 2012 where they did very rigorous overfeeding with varying levels of protein. So like the levels of protein were 5% of energy up to 25% of energy, which I think spanned all the way from like right around the RDA, like close to that, like 0.7 or 0.8 grams per kilogram, all the way up to like 3 grams per kilogram. And this study was complete inpatient metabolic ward. Every calorie that these individuals consumed for the study period, and I think it was 8 weeks, which is really impressive if that's the case, every morsel they ate was prepared and provided by the research staff, and every instance of them consuming calories was supervised by the research staff. And in that scenario, there was nothing weird about protein overfeeding. There was no like loophole where it's like, man, these are like free calories. Everything made sense in terms of the amount of fat mass that was gained and the amount of fat-free mass that was gained. So with protein overfeeding, the closer you get to really tightly controlled designs, the more protein overfeeding completely makes sense and does exactly what you'd expect. The additional calories, there's a little bit of increase in energy expenditure due to the thermic effect of feeding. That might have a little impact on the propensity to store fat just because of burning calories. Nothing biochemically weird about that. And then the fat-free mass, you know, it really just comes down to, you know, if you're having a huge increase in protein intake from a very low protein diet, you're probably going to store some extra fat-free mass just because you were under eating protein previously. But yeah, I know that there are some studies floating around that make it seem like there's some weird biochemical stuff going on with protein overfeeding, almost like it's some kind of biochemistry loophole that gives you free calories. It's really not the case. And unfortunately, you know, the calories that are going in are going to be dealt with either through an increase in thermogenesis or just storage of tissue. So that's it. Yeah. So high protein overfeeding, can it lead to fat gain? Absolutely. And that fat gain is very much in line with what we would calculate based on our understanding of metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You are up, Greg.
All righty. So this first question I'm addressing is from Derek in the Facebook group. And I'm primarily addressing it not because I have a great answer to it, but because every time we throw up Q&A threads, someone asks some variation of this question. And I've avoided attempting to answer it for a long time, so whatever, just going to rip the Band-Aid off, mostly just to be able to link this every other time this question comes up. Anyway, the question is, I have always wondered why I ache more during my deload week. It doesn't even need to be after an entire block of training. My back tends to ache more a few days into the deload than it ever does during my training weeks. I have more nagging, aching, and pains as well. So, you know, basically, why might someone be experiencing more physical discomfort during deload weeks than, you know, when they're actually like actively training pretty hard? So the explanation that I've heard for this, so one thing just to note on the front end, I've not seen like direct human research on this. So we're purely in the realm of anecdote and kind of looking around for potential explanatory mechanisms. So anyone who is answering this question with a super high degree of confidence, either they're aware of research that I was unable to find, or they're just kind of bullshitting. So just be aware of that on the front end. And I am going to do my best to not bullshit you with this answer. But yeah, so the explanation that I've heard from other sources before is that when you're training hard, you're putting stressors on your body, and as a result, your sympathetic nervous system output ramps up, and along with that comes increases in catecholamine levels. So epinephrine, norepinephrine, basically adrenaline. And those chemicals can, to some degree, like numb pain or discomfort responses. Like, you know, I'm sure you've heard anecdotes from like athletes who maybe have a rolled ankle, but, you know, they put on an ankle brace and get on the court and, you know, they just forget that they've injured their ankle while they're actually playing. And then they get off the court and like they're limping all over the place. Like the pain comes back. And so, you know, maybe that's just purely due to adrenaline. And I don't know that I fully buy that explanation for a couple reasons. One is that it is true that when you're putting a lot of stressors on your body, even when you're not necessarily, you know, actively exercising, your base, like your catecholamine levels at rest could still be elevated to some degree. So if you track HRV, for example, heart rate variability, that's one of those things that it's roughly trying to assess. If you have low heart rate variability, even at rest, that means your sympathetic nervous system, even at rest, is ramped up a little bit. So, you know, that dynamic is in play, but I think that the level of sympathetic nervous system output and the level of adrenaline you need to like pretty significantly numb pain is quite a bit higher than it would be at rest, even if it is somewhat elevated from baseline. You know, so when you're actually training, you might get a pretty intense analgesic response, like a pain reducing response from some of those chemicals. But even if they are slightly elevated at rest, I don't know that it would be enough to be physiologically relevant for like numbing pain and discomfort. And another reason that I'm somewhat skeptical of that explanation is there are other things that you can do that can ramp up catecholamine output that also have a tendency to simultaneously increase pain perception. So for example, after just like one or two like very poor or very short nights of sleep, sympathetic nervous system activity will ramp up while you're awake, basically just to try to keep you awake and alert. Even though you're poorly rested, and inadequate sleep also tends to be associated with increased pain perception. So there are other things that have a similar effect on the sympathetic nervous system as a training block would, that would tend to increase pain perception rather than decrease it. So, you know, that is a set of physiological mechanisms that may be related to this phenomenon to some degree, but I'm skeptical that it fully explains it. One other possibility is just that, you know, maybe you ache more because you're moving less overall. So in kind of like the pain and physical rehab literature, one of the things that you see pretty consistently is that just exercise in general has a pretty robust and consistent general analgesic effect. Or in other words, like, if you move more, you tend to hurt less. Just, you know, not in all conceivable situations and all conceivable things that might be causing pain. But in general, if you're very sedentary, or if your activity levels decrease quite a bit, that could make you hurt a little bit more. And if you're a little bit more active, you tend to just be in a little bit less discomfort. So, you know, that could be all that's going on. Like, it's your deload week. So you're taking it easier in the gym. And maybe as a result, like, or even purposefully, one of the things people will often do when they're deloading is they just try to take it easy in general. Like, the idea being, you know, I'm trying to rest, I'm trying to recuperate. So I'm not going to go out of my way to be active, or I might even go out of my way to be a bit of a couch potato this week to really, you know, let myself fully recuperate from this training block I just did. So, you know, that could just be the dynamic at play. Like, your overall activity levels are lower, you know, and as a result, the general levels of discomfort you feel are a bit higher. So that's another potential explanation. Again, I don't think that would be a complete explanation of this phenomenon, but that could be another input in play. And then another potential explanation is it could just be a matter of your brain basically filtering the inputs coming to it and kind of giving primacy to whatever the most intense input is. So that was a very bad just introduction to this explanation. But basically, like, you're training hard. Maybe you're experiencing some pretty intense or, you know, at least like moderate DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness. So, you know, it could be that those sensations like maybe a little back pain, maybe some joint aches or whatever, like maybe those things are there all the time, but there's kind of a finite amount of stuff that your brain can make you aware of. Like your conscious mind is limited in terms of like how much you can perceive and process all at once. And so it could just be a matter of like, you know, your brain is trying to send you what it perceives to be the most relevant information. And so, you know, it makes you aware of pain and discomfort. And so it could just be that you're experiencing enough muscle soreness when you're training hard that those kind of like lower level discomfort signals that are getting to your brain aren't intense enough to kind of get pushed into your conscious perception. And then once you remove some of those other like uncomfortable sensations as a result of training, then maybe some more of that low level stuff is now, you know, the most intense discomfort you're feeling. And so your brain just kind of pushes that into your conscious awareness. So that could be what's going on as well. All of which is to say, I think of those three things I mentioned, all of them could be contributing. None of them could be contributing. It's hard to say. We don't know for sure. So just generally interpret that as food for thought.
Good stuff. I will admit, normally you're the person that takes forever. I went really long with my first question, so I'm going to try to do this one really quickly in All the right. interest of our dedication to shorter episodes.
Where are we at already?
We're close to 30 minutes in.
Hell yeah.
So not great. I had a question from Numerous Safety 3796, and this was from a long time ago. I also was kind of putting this off, much like you were with the last question. I just didn't want to get into it because it's about ashwagandha and performance effects. So the question is basically, what are my thoughts about ashwagandha for physical performance? And it also specifically refers to a meta-analysis. Now, when I first got this question, I was like, cool, a meta-analysis. I love digging into those. If you're a mass subscriber, like I had a really painful hobby for a while there of kind of taking metas apart, finding some little calculation errors and then putting them back together. I say it was a painful hobby because that takes so long if there's more than like four studies. So anyway, I opened this up thinking it'd be an opportunity because I know the ashwagandha exercise literature is not that big. So yeah. I was like, oh, I can dig into this and probably find some errors and put it back together. I think the meta-analysis itself was done quite well. My concern is I just think the body of literature is so scattered and inconsistent, and I think the mechanisms are so vague, I truly don't know what to do with it. And usually when I'm there with a supplement, I say, listen, if you're really intrigued and you want to give it a shot, there's enough safety data to suggest that as long as it's not an adulterated product and not just... And you're following dosing guidelines. Like, if you want to take a crack at it, take a crack at it. But I haven't seen enough evidence, despite the existence of this meta-analysis, to really feel good about recommending ashwagandha for performance purposes. If you look around at some of the research that people often point at when it comes to ashwagandha as a performance booster, there was one paper that I see floating around every now and then that... You know, like over the course of, I think, maybe 8 weeks or so, you know, it was kind of a standard length for a training intervention. It was like 8, maybe 10 weeks or so. The ashwagandha group added 46 kilograms to their bench press. And so like,
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, it was 8 weeks. So yeah. Maybe that happened. Maybe it didn't. But if it did happen...
That's like, a lot of kilos.
my question is, to whom does that really generalize? You know, like,
yeah.
Ashwagandha is not going to add 46 kilograms to your bench press. So I don't know what to do with that particular finding. But that's one that a lot of people get excited about. And to be fair, like maybe they were just really, 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 really untrained. There was no familiarization. And so it was just like, hey, over the next 8 weeks, we are going to teach you how to bench press and sprinkle in some additional supplement magic. And here we go. But in any case, there's nothing that I can do with that, right?
Yeah.
So there's also, if you look at the effect sizes within this meta-analysis, you would kind of be left to conclude that ashwagandha is more effective than creatine by a pretty comfortable margin. And I find that to be implausible at this point in time, just because of inconsistency from study to study. And also, like I mentioned, the mechanism doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Some papers will talk very vaguely about ashwagandha's mechanisms and say like, well, it's, you know, you're doing these stressful things and ashwagandha will make them less stressful. And all of a sudden you're benching 46 more kilograms. And I'm like, you got to get me closer to how I got those 46 kilograms.
Yeah. I mean, if that is the relevant mechanism, just like, dude, you should see a similar ergogenic effect from smoking weed.
Right.
doing a little something to take the edge off in the evening.
But yeah, I mean, I was looking at one paper and it says it referred to, this is a quote, anti-stress effects, neuroprotective effects, immunomodulatory effects, and rejuvenating effects via the herb's interplay with the nervous system, the endocrine system, the cardiopulmonary system, energy production system, and the immune system, including analgesic, antimicrobial, anti-inflammatory, anti-tumor, anti-stress, anti-diabetic, neuroprotective, immunoprotective, and cardioprotective effects.
Good shit.
So like, what am I supposed to do with that? Like,
yeah,
it just does all things in all contexts. So, yeah. But when you start to dig into it a little bit, you basically will find two primary like specific mechanisms. One is cortisol reduction, which I don't think you could really say, you know, yeah, cortisol is leading to the effects we see in that meta-analysis, effects of that magnitude.
Man, and in addition to that, there was a paper, I think it came from Stu Phillips's lab, maybe like 2013, 2014, thereabouts, like back when the acute hormone hypothesis for training adaptations was kind of the hot topic, and people were doing research to see like, you know, does that seem to be like the primary mechanism for muscular adaptations? So they had a paper where they were looking at the correlations between hormonal responses to training and resistance training adaptations. It was either strength gains or hypertrophy. It was one of the two. But if memory serves, because I didn't pull this paper up before recording, if memory serves, they looked at changes in testosterone, cortisol, growth hormone, IGF-1. I think it was those four. And none of them were associated with training adaptations except for cortisol, which was positively associated with training adaptations.
Right.
So like, you know, I wouldn't necessarily want to take correlation data from a single paper at face value. But I mean, of the human data that I'm aware of, a relatively large cortisol response post-training probably either doesn't meaningfully predict training adaptations or might be positively predictive of training adaptations. So like if that's the main mechanism you're hanging your hat on, like, oh yeah, this reduces cortisol, I don't know. I don't even know that that's a good thing.
Right. And you know, there is a distinction between, you know, kind of basal resting cortisol throughout the day versus the acute fluctuations from training. But
yeah, for sure.
Again, it's, yeah, there's minimal evidence to suggest that a little reduction in cortisol, whether we're talking about during exercise, post-exercise, or throughout the day, is going to have dramatic effects on body composition performance. So, and then sometimes people say, well, no, it's affecting the HPA or the HPG axis, but it's more affecting testosterone. It's increasing testosterone. And ashwagandha is not increasing your testosterone enough to have those types of ergogenic effects. You need a big change in testosterone to have a significant ergogenic effect on that magnitude.
Has anyone checked to see the ectosterone content of ashwagandha?
That's a good question. Another mechanism that does come up is sometimes they say, listen, it's got antioxidant properties and that's good. But I wrote an article for Stronger by Science about antioxidants. There are many of them. They do antioxidant things quite well, and they do not have these types of performance outcomes. So maybe, to be fair, maybe ashwagandha is remarkably efficacious as an ergogenic aid, and we simply have no idea what the mechanism is. But to me, that's not enough to get me really to latch onto a supplement and recommend it. I need to see, consistent, plausible effect sizes that make sense based on a mechanism that has been supported by some experimental research. Mm-hmm. And right now, there's just really a disconnect where the effect sizes are really big. There are very few of them. They are a bit inconsistent from study to study. I can't really point to a mechanism that would tie it all together. So when it comes to ashwagandha for performance, I'm personally going to sit this out. I've taken ashwagandha before for an extended period of time because there is some amount of evidence suggesting that it might help with attenuating symptoms of like very mild anxiety. So I've taken it for that. Whether or not I experienced a placebo effect from it, I don't really know. It didn't like change my life, but it seemed fine. But I certainly didn't notice pronounced ergogenic effects when I was taking ashwagandha for that type of outcome. So, if you're super intrigued by it, by all means, you can give it a shot. Just make sure you're not getting an adulterated product. Make sure you're taking it within recommended dosage guidelines. You can take a shot on it if you'd like, but personally, I don't see strong evidence supporting an ergogenic effect with plausible, consistent effect sizes with a mechanism that would explain how it would be doing that type of thing. But I do want to say, I want to acknowledge that, this does kind of fall under that Ayurvedic medicine umbrella. There are some traditions and cultures in which ashwagandha is held in really high regard. And so I don't mean to be disrespectful to any of those traditional elements or cultural elements. If you really like using ashwagandha for reasons that are based on, culture, tradition, whatever the case may be, I'm not trying to be a dick and insult that or take away from that or anything. But when people have these questions for us about supplements, it's usually through the prism of kind of by the book evidence-based medicine or evidence-based practice. Do you see enough evidence empirically to support this? I'm not seeing the experimental evidence that I would need to justify promoting it as an ergogenic aid.
Yeah, and I just want to add one thing to head off a maybe like a potential criticism of the answer you just gave. One of the things you said is like you might have more faith in it if there was more high quality human research on it. One thing that I know that some people's brains will go to is like, well, there's a reason that there's not that much research on it. Like, it's an herb. You can't patent it. There's no profit motive. So, like, people aren't going to, pour the same sort of money into research because there's no way that you can, like, monetize this the same way you could other things. Like, that's a common, like, anti-pharma talking point. But in the case of supplement research, like, that just doesn't pass the smell test for reality, because like a lot of the most studied supplements out there is shit that can't be patented because it's naturally occurring. So like creatine, for example, or caffeine or fish oil, I think those are the three, like 1, 2, and 3, the most studied supplements in existence, and they're all stuff that exists in nature that you can't patent. Like you can package and sell it, but it's the same sort of thing as an herbal extract. I know that some people's brains will go there as kind of an explanation for why there's not more high quality human data on it. But in the case of supplementation, that critique just doesn't hold water.
Yeah. And like I said, some of these findings, they're just, the effect sizes just seem too big to me. And I know that, when people hear that, the first thing they think is just like straight up fraud. That's not what I'm suggesting, but like a lot of times with studies, the first few papers that trickle out for any particular supplement or treatment, whatever the case may be, a lot of times we see really inflated effect sizes, and we see effect sizes that are not generalizable, that are not representative of the true effect size. And only after we get a ton of different studies do we start to see, oh, the early phase of research for this ingredient, we saw a lot of publication bias, and we saw a lot of inflated effect sizes that were not necessarily due to fraud or anything like that, but they were just sampling error and kind of the like first finder's effect, where mm-hmm. where the first time you do it, there could be several very uninteresting ashwagandha studies that are just kind of sitting in cupboards, you know, in the file drawer. And, it's only when you happen to get this kind of non-generalizable but flashy finding do you say, ooh, this is something that could really make a splash. So anyway, yeah, I'm not that into it as an ergogenic aid, but if you're into it, hey, more power to you.
I feel you. All right, moving on. I have a question from the Stronger by Science subreddit. From no_attention6969, who says, Greg, how are your lifts with weight loss? Have you been able to maintain somewhat, mitigating losses? Any things you found that have helped maintain strength, or that have helped you maintain your strength while cutting? And so this is another question that I've gotten a lot. I've been recently doing like weekly Instagram Q&As, and this question or some version of it will be asked 5 or 6 times. But since I don't save those Q&As and we do save the podcast, I'm going to answer it here. I've gotten a lot weaker with my weight loss for reasons that I think are largely unrelated to the weight loss. So, I started my cut in February of last year. Towards the end of this month, it will be a year that the road to the stage has been active, and I am positive that I've gotten a lot weaker through that process. But the primary reason why is through a lot of that time, I just wasn't lifting or wasn't lifting particularly hard. So last, I don't remember for sure, it was either April or May. It was like when it was starting to get warm. Anyway, I broke my wrist and fucked up some of the ligaments in my left elbow. And so like a piece of advice that I commonly give people, and there's research to support this, is if you injure one side of your body, if you continue training the other side of your body, it will help with strength maintenance for the injured side that you can't train. I didn't do that. Mostly because it was my left arm, which is, I'm a righty. My left arm's my weak one anyway. If I would have hurt my right arm, I would have said, I'll keep training my left arm. That's fine. I don't have any need for my right arm to get that much stronger when my left is already injured and I can't train it. That contributed. And then also since it was like a wrist issue, I had no grip strength. So, I couldn't do any like rowing or whatnot, couldn't really grip a bar well to deadlift. Also couldn't like just support any weight on my shoulders to squat, didn't have the wrist mobility to front squat. Even a safety bar squat, like just the pressure from the handles, like I couldn't take any pressure down on that wrist at all. So I just didn't do much of anything for a few months while that was rehabbing. And I think that was very, very useful for me, actually. So one of the kind of like mental hurdles that I run into when trying to lose weight is since I do value strength training so much, and since I value my own physical strength so much, one of the kind of mental hurdles I'd always run up against is like when a diet would be going pretty well, but my strength would start taking a little bit of a hit, that made it challenging to continue to be bought into the diet. Just because like I did kind of have maybe like an irrational fear of getting any weaker. So I think breaking my wrist and not training for a while was actually very useful, because then I could just kind of metabolize that and take it in. I'm like, well, I can't train the way I want to for a while. I am going to get weaker. But what's this other goal I have? I'm trying to lose weight. Okay, cool. Like I can just focus on that. And then like by the time everything was healed up enough that I could start training more consistently again, I was enough weaker that instead of it being stressful, like, oh man, I'm going to lose strength from this like current high level of strength, it's like, ah, whatever, I'm already so much weaker that I can just go lift weights and it's fun. And I'm not really losing anything on the back end. So yeah, like I don't know the degree to which just not training affected my strength versus losing weight. Both of them probably contributed. But yeah, I've gotten a lot weaker and I'm at this point completely fine with it. And now that I am training more consistently again, the strength is coming back really quickly. Like the first time, like once my wrist could handle compressive loading pretty well and I put some weight back on the bar to bench press, I ground out a very, very challenging single at 315. And then by like my third bench press workout back, I did like a pretty comfortable triple with 315 on low incline. So, you know, that's probably somewhere around like a triple at 355-ish for flat. So, you know, it's coming back quick. And I'm sure a month from now, my strength will still be lower than it was pre-cut. But like, I'm pretty sure I'll retrain back to a relatively strong place. Anyway, don't know if that's the answer you were looking for. I've definitely gotten weaker. A lot of it was just from not training. Just accepting that I was going to lose strength and kind of using that injury as a mechanism to allow me to accept that, I think has actually been very, very helpful for me. So, yep, that's where I'm at.
Good stuff. So I'm up next. I got a question that's been, I've gotten like three questions that are kind of like this. So I kind of merged them all into one. With the road to Athens taking the Stronger by Science world by storm, everybody's crazy about it. There's a lot of questions about cardio these days. So someone asked me, is high intensity interval training better than low or moderate intensity steady state for body composition purposes? So looking at different approaches to cardio, high intensity intervals versus steady state exercise. And also, what are some good interval training protocols and how do you gauge intensity for those protocols? So I had a very recent article in Mass that was about this. There was a meta-analysis by James Steele and colleagues, and James is very, very good at doing research, so highly recommend his work. They looked at a big old group of studies comparing steady state versus interval type training. They were specifically looking at changes in fat mass and fat free mass, so looking at body composition. And what they found was no meaningful difference in terms of fat loss or gains in fat free mass. So fairly modest effect for both outcomes. In both cases, they lost about a quarter of a kilogram of fat and gained like a tenth of a kilogram of fat free mass, which is an important point. So first of all, cardio or endurance type exercise, it's great for a lot of things, but its independent effects on weight loss really are not that big. So a lot of times some people say, oh, I'm going to take up running as an independent standalone fat loss endeavor. And in many cases, you know, you might find that you have really, really positive impacts on your health, really great impacts on appetite regulation, things like that. But, you know, as a standalone fat loss intervention, probably leaves a little bit to be desired. Doesn't mean it's not great for your health and well-being, but if fat loss and weight loss truly are the goal, you probably want to do a mixture of doing some additional physical activity, whether it's cardio or otherwise, and then adding in a dietary component of some type. Anyway, it's important to recognize with this meta-analysis, this was only one of the studies in the meta-analysis included resistance training. So that obviously is a limitation considering that most of our listeners do a lot of resistance training. So the question is, would the analysis, would it have turned out way different if resistance training were included in a lot of these individual studies? I would argue probably not. You know, the interference effect is usually where people start getting really focused when you talk about combining cardio with resistance training. multiple meta-analyses now have shown that the interference effect is pretty minimal for strength and very minimal for hypertrophy, as long as your resistance training and your endurance training component are being managed effectively. Like, if you really wanted to, you could use the interference effect to mess up your gains, but you'd have to be trying pretty hard. You'd have to be doing a lot of things poorly to make that work. In most cases...
Or just already be at a really, really high level in one of the two pursuits.
Correct. Yeah. But in most cases, adding a little bit of cardio or endurance training into your lifting program, very unlikely to have a catastrophic effect on your strength gains, and even less likely when it comes to body composition hypertrophy. Now, my favorite HIIT protocols that I like to do, if you choose to go that route, you could take one approach that would probably fall under the umbrella of sprint interval training. And the distinction between high intensity interval training and sprint interval training is pretty straightforward. The sprint stuff is all out. It's maximal intensity. So I do a type of sprint interval training every now and then where I'll do 30 seconds all out, you know, RPE 10 maximal intensity. And then I'll spend 90 seconds below the kind, I forget what the term is, but in grad school, they mentioned like the conversation threshold, basically an intensity of endurance type exercise where you could still hold a pretty comfortable conversation while doing it, right? So it's, I don't know how to convert that to a specific RPE, but pretty chill, pretty light. You're basically using 90 seconds to recover, and then you're right back into another 30-second sprint. So I'll do that for 10 or 15 sprints in whatever modality you choose, cycling, running, swimming, whatever the case may be. I also like a high-intensity interval training protocol that's very straightforward. It's just 1 minute on, 1 minute off. The high-intensity part of it, I try to do it in RPE of like 9 or 10. So like the way I would frame that is if I'm doing it on a treadmill, by the end of that minute, I'm like, man, it's kind of drifting toward the back of the treadmill a little bit. You know, it's tough. You feel like you're really at that 9 or 10 level with the RPE out of 10, obviously. And then the 1 minute recovery, I'll either rest entirely or I'll just do some light stuff below that conversational threshold where I could easily hold a conversation while I'm doing it. Another less intense protocol I'll do is quite similar, but I'll do 2 minutes on and 2 minutes off. And with that, I knock the RPE down a little bit to like an 8 to maybe like a 9.5. So not knocking the intensity down a little bit, but obviously doubling the duration of the high intensity interval there. And if I do that, I might only do like half the round. So instead of doing 10 1 minute high interval bouts, I'll do like 5 2-minute high interval bouts. And like I said, the modality is not critical. Cycling, swimming, rowing, running, paddling, whatever you want to do. You just want to make sure you find a safe way to do it. So you don't want to throw yourself off the back of a treadmill. You don't want to be in a precarious position where you like fatigue yourself swimming in open water. Obviously, that would be dangerous if you're not a strong swimmer. But yeah, a lot of ways to do it. And high intensity interval training is, you know, a very viable way to get some of the benefits of aerobic exercise or cardio type or endurance type exercise, as long as you're not doing it so much with such high intensity that you are just completely wiped out for your lifting sessions. Mm-hmm. You should be fine, but that is something to keep an eye on, obviously. And then finally, the biggest caveat is I answered this question specifically within the context of body composition. If you're adding some type of endurance training for reasons that go beyond body composition or cardiovascular health or cardiometabolic health, things like that, if you're trying to add in endurance type exercise to cultivate a specific physiological capacity, if you're doing it for a specific performance reason, it's a completely different answer. Obviously, when you're doing that, you need to make sure that you are tailoring your endurance type exercise to really target the key energy systems that you're trying to develop. So that would be a completely different scenario where you would have to really sort out the details with your intensity, your duration, your modality. But if you're just doing it for general health and well-being or to burn a couple extra calories, you know, things of that nature, really not critical whether you pick one or the other.
Makes sense to me. All right. Where are we at time-wise?
54 minutes.
All right. So this will probably be my last one, I reckon.
Cool.
So Colin Quirk from Reddit asks, Have there been any attempts to quantify the benefits associated with personalizing training? For example, working with a coach or creating your own program versus following a more general program. Furthermore, is there a training age where this benefit kicks in? True novices probably don't need to personalize that much. At what point does this benefit, assuming it exists, start to kick in? So yeah, basically just asking, is there, like, have we quantified the benefits associated with personalizing training? And in terms of resistance training, not really. So there was a really, really cool paper published in Frontiers a couple years back, the title of which is Effectiveness of an Individualized Training Based on Force Velocity Profiling During Jumping by Jimenez-Reyes and colleagues. That will be linked in the show notes. I would recommend checking that out. Very, very cool paper. What they did in that study essentially is the athletes, they would bring them in, do a force velocity profile. Probably don't have time to explain how they would quantify whether someone was strong versus fast. But basically there is a theoretically optimal force velocity profile for jumping where, you know, if you are naturally very explosive, like if you're your angular velocities can be very, very fast, like with no load, but you're relatively weak. If you kind of like pull that load velocity profile up there somewhere in the middle, that would roughly correspond with body weight. That will increase your specific ability to create force and power for jumping versus someone who's already pretty strong, but then their maximum contractile velocity is quite slow. If you kind of if you're able to kind of pull that curve out, that would also increase power output there towards the middle of the curve where vertical jumping is occurring. So basically, they profiled all of the subjects, and they had a group where they like trained whichever side of the curve people were bad at. So basically, if someone was strong but slow, they would just do like very, very low weight over speed type stuff to try to improve maximum contractile velocity. And if someone was already quite fast but relatively weak, they would just have them train maximal strength to try to improve that functional capacity. And then they had another group of people as well who kind of trained all capacities just in general. So they would do what's called like optimal load training, where essentially you would train with the sorts of power and force outputs that would be associated with what you're trying to improve. So in this case, vertical jump, and then also some strength work, also some speed work. So just kind of like a generalized vertical jumping program. And so in that study where they did tailor the training intervention for all of the individuals, the group of people on the individualized program did have much better vertical jumping outcomes than just kind of the more generalized program did. So, you know, I kind of view that as a proof of concept. You know, a maximum squat is not a maximum vertical jump, but it is kind of a proof of concept that if you adequately quantify what people are lacking in and develop an individualized training intervention to, you know, target those things where people could improve, then you might have better outcomes. But like I said, that's not specifically like trying to improve maximal strength. One other thing just to generally note is that oftentimes, like this question asked about working with a coach to create an individualized program for you. One thing to note is that just merely having a coach, regardless of the quality of their programming, might still improve your results. So there have been a handful of studies that have looked at supervised versus unsupervised training, or supervised training with a high ratio of lifters to trainers versus a low ratio of lifters to trainers. And those studies will be linked in the show notes as well. But what these studies find is essentially they will have two groups of people. They put them on the same training program, and one of the groups has basically research assistants working with them the whole time. So, you know, loading the bar for them, spotting them, giving them encouragement, whatever. And then the other group of people, there is still a research assistant sitting in the room. And like, you can ask them questions like, hey, I think I'm supposed to go up and wait on this. Like, should I? Or like, hey, how did my form look? But they're not like actively monitoring and coaching you through the entire workout. But it's the same training program regardless. And in the supervised versus unsupervised groups, the people with more either supervision or more direct supervision, or kind of more one-on-one, hands-on type supervision, even on the same training program, those people tend to build more strength. So, you know, regardless of the individualized program, just simply having a coach and someone that you're accountable to, especially if it's someone you can work with in person, that in and of itself might improve your results. And one other thing to note as well is, even though there haven't been all that many studies in resistance training that have specifically looked at individualizing training in the way we would probably think of it, so, you know, doing a big intake questionnaire to try to tailor every programming variable to someone's unique needs and specifications, there are a lot of studies that use a research paradigm called a within subject unilateral design, where basically if there are two training interventions, instead of recruiting subjects and splitting them into two groups, what you do is just recruit one group of subjects and like split their sides of their body into different training programs. So like, you know, you might have one leg doing high intensity training and the other leg doing high volume training. And essentially you look to see if, like, within individual, you know, someone's leg responds much better to one style of programming versus another, or just like one mix of training variables versus another. And in those studies, what you tend to see is that people who respond well to training just respond well to training, period. And people who don't respond well to training don't respond well to training, period. Like the within subject correlation between training responses leg to leg or arm to arm tend to be quite high, where if you respond well to one program, you'll probably respond well to the other program as well. There was one particular within subject unilateral design study that's not coming to mind right now, but the details of it come to mind. So it was looking at manipulating frequency and volume, where, if memory serves, there were three conditions. There was a twice per week training, three times per week training, and five times per week training, if memory serves. And essentially, the workout days were the same regardless. So, you know, it was just like three sets of quad work every time you train. And so, you know, the like training five times per week, not only was frequency higher, but total volume was higher as well, because the per session volume was the same regardless. And so that study also used a within subject unilateral design. And that's the only paper coming to mind where there really were pretty big within individual differences, where some of the people did respond quite a bit better to the lower volume and frequency, and some people did respond quite a bit better to the higher volume and frequency, where, like, you know, if you had one 2x leg and one 5x leg, on average, there were larger gains in the 5x legs than the 2x legs. But there were quite a few individuals where the 2x leg or the 3x leg did have quite a bit larger gains than the 5x leg. And that suggests to me, like, because there have been all sorts of interventions that have used that sort of experimental design. And that's the only study coming to mind that used that type of intervention, where there were pretty large within subject differences between sides of their body, which suggests to me that more than anything else, the factor that needs to be individualized is just total training volume and kind of like the optimal level of volume for hypertrophy and strength outcomes probably does vary quite a bit between individuals. So, you know, if you're looking for, you know, hey, I do want to individualize my training, what variable should I look at that will likely give me the most bang for my buck? I think a combination of volume and frequency probably are the things that need to be individualized the most. And other factors, you know, might make a small difference, but probably aren't going to make just a night and day difference in terms of results. So yeah, that wasn't a very direct and succinct answer to that question. Long story short, there's not that much research on specifically on just kind of the generalized concept of individualizing resistance training versus putting everyone on the same program, largely just because that would be a difficult study to design and for it to pass peer review. Like, you know, if you're, say, trying to customize four different variables, you got frequency, intensity, volume, and exercise selection or something like that, and you have a big screening questionnaire where, you know, you try to optimize all four of those variables for a group of 20 people versus another group of 20 people who are all just put on the same training program, you would probably wind up with, on average, different enough training interventions in those two groups that reviewers would look at the paper and be like, well, you know, what are you actually studying here? Like, maybe the concept of individualization, but what if the individualized group just wound up training with way higher training volumes? Like, could you really say that individualization was the driver here versus just whatever other training variables wound up differing between the groups? So, you know, I would be interested in reading that study, but I would not want to be the person designing and conducting that study. So yeah, direct research, pretty lacking. But like I said, with the vertical jump study, there is just kind of like conceptual evidence in favor of individualization. I do think that a lot of the benefits from working with a coach might come from the program itself, but I think a lot of them just come from working with a coach, and there are inherent benefits to doing that. And if you're interested in kind of indirect evidence related to individualizing training variables and the sorts of magnitudes of difference you could expect from tweaking a variable here or there, just keep an eye out for studies that employ a within-subject unilateral design, because that's sort of the research approach that gives us the best evidence for the types of differences you could expect within subject from tweaking a variable here or there.
You know, I think you said something really important there, that somebody ought to do that research as long as it's not you.
Yep.
As you know, I cut my teeth in the laboratory with my hands on the ultrasound. And the further I get removed from it, I find myself saying that more and more and more. I'm just like, man, somebody's got to do this. But absolutely not me.
Yeah.
It is hard work, man. Doing research is tough. And in that spirit, I do want to kind of clarify and contextualize one of my previous answers. I was talking flippantly about a study about ashwagandha, and I said, like, oh, bench press went up 46 kilograms. Maybe that happened. Maybe it didn't. I said something like that. I want to clarify that because I don't want it to sound like I'm alleging fraud or disparaging the individuals associated with the study. My concern with that study is the change in bench press, even in the placebo group, is astronomical.
Wasn't it like 24 kilos in the placebo group or something like that?
26.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason I say, you know, maybe that happened, maybe it didn't, it's not that I'm not like alleging anything nefarious or anything like that, but my concern is that without a really good standard or a really good familiarization phase, if you are recruiting from a pool of individuals who are ready to add that much to their bench press in 8 weeks, there is so much noise and volatility. There are so many big things happening in your data fully unrelated to the supplement intervention that it really undermines the generalizability of those findings. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to clarify that point. My big concern there is, like, if you have this group of people who they're just going to touch this weight and grow no matter what, it's really hard to make inferences about a supplement within that context. And I think that the baseline bench press measurements were very, very low, and probably they would have had more generalizable data if they just kind of bit the bullet and said, let's do 6 weeks or 8 weeks of familiarization and then begin the supplement trial. Because when you've got, you know, the placebo group almost doubling their bench press in 8 weeks, what could you possibly say about what the actual supplement's doing? There's so much noise and volatility. I mean, there's just a lot of moving parts when you have that much lack of familiarity with the testing outcome that's being measured.
Yeah.
So Yeah, it's one of those things when you do the research, you realize like, man, we got to give people a break and be more charitable with, you know, with how we interpret studies. But anyway, I just wanted to clarify that to out of respect for the authors. Now, to play us out, Stronger by Science is the name of the show. I assume that many of our listeners enjoy science as an extension of that. Mm-hmm. One of my big regrets in life that I may never shake is I never got to take a good comparative physiology course where you look at physiology of different animals, because physiology in the animal kingdom is insane, like absolutely remarkable. So I assume that our listeners love a good physiology fun fact, and boy, do I have a couple. I was reading about the Arctic waters. Don't ask why. That's not important. I was curious, but mm-hmm. I came across two animals that, this is just mind blowing. So the longest living mammal happens to be, up in the northern waters, floating around in the ocean there. Longest living mammal is the bowhead whale. Lifespan. We've already talked about this, so I'm not going to do the pretend guessing game. This is a whale, and the lifespan is estimated up to 200, maybe even 300 years for a mammal. Just absolutely insane.
That's a long time.
So I heard that, and I was like, man, I can't believe these things are floating around in the water up there. Clearly, they're the oldest thing around. Not even true. In the very same waters floating around up there is the Greenland shark. This is not a mammal, obviously, but the longest living vertebrate, according to these estimates. Lifespan of up to 400 to maybe even 500 years. Just absolutely incredible. So I must admit, you know, right now, one of the things I see on Instagram all the time is sensationalizing ice baths for literally every outcome. You know, take an ice bath if you want to grow taller, if your teeth are itchy, everything in between. So, maybe I'm wrong, dude. Maybe that's what's doing it, is these sharks and these whales are floating around up there in the chilly Arctic waters, and they're just living like 500 years. Pretty incredible.
Maybe so. Who's to say?
All right. Are you good for this episode? Are we ready to close it out?
Hmm.
Any parting words for the listeners?
Let me think. No, I don't think so.
Perfect.
All right.
That'll generate a lot of curiosity for what you'll cook up next week. All right. So that does it for our special Q&A episode here. We will be back in exactly 1 week. As always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to the Stronger by Science podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, be sure to sign up for our free newsletter to get concise breakdowns of relevant research, as well as 28 free training programs for all skill levels and all schedules. We hate spam just as much as you do, so we'll only email you when we have something really interesting to share with you. You can sign up for the free newsletter at strongerbyscience.com/newsletter, or just go to the Stronger by Science homepage and click the free programs button at the top. If you want to join in on the Stronger by Science podcast conversation, be sure to check out our Facebook group and our subreddit. The links for both are provided in the description of today's episode. Finally, please remember that we are not medical doctors or registered dietitians. So, before you make any changes to your exercise or nutrition habits, be sure to check with a qualified healthcare professional. Once again, thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode of the Stronger by Science podcast.